Okay, let's go from bulbs to booze. Didn't take a ton of research for Chicago historian Richard Lindbergh's latest book, Just the Lessons of Life. Lindbergh documents the Swedish-American experience in Chicago in Whiskey Breakfast, My Swedish Family, My American Life. For Lindbergh, it was a long overdue and cathartic therapy. WBEZ's Jason Mark recently sat down with Lindbergh, who began by explaining that keeping things hidden is part of Swedish culture.
The Swedes stayed out of the limelight. It was simply the nature of Swedish life. The Swedish history in Chicago is not all that remarkable. It's a story of an immigrant people that were very taciturn, reserved, always played by the rules. They had perhaps the lowest crime rate of any ethnic group in the city. They did not enter the Chicago political scene in numbers. But by and large, it's a community that was very insulated and kept to itself, followed its folkloric customs through the fraternal lodges that they launched up and down Clark Street. Today in Sweden, families, they don't want to talk about scandal. They don't want to dredge up the past. My biggest challenge was to try to pull these stories out of my cousins. And they would say to me, well, why do you want to know about that? It's so long ago. Let it go. Forget about it. Push it all under the rug. In a way, it breeds kind of a neurosis in Sweden, the long, cold winters of lack of daylight, the internal brooding. We call that mörkertiden, the murky times. It's actually, it's not a Swedish word, but it's adopted to describe the kind of Swedish culture.
So, as you mentioned, like the Swedes themselves in Chicago, your own family's history, at least your father's, was hidden from you for pretty much your entire life. Your dad was, to put it gently, a complicated man. Who was Oscar Lindbergh?
He was a man of enormous self-pride, bordering on ego obsession. He was a self-made man, self-educated, a man who had been brutally beaten by his father and ran away from home in southern Sweden when he was 16 years old. My father was a radical. He was a Trotskyite. He supported the Russian Revolution. He believed in free love. He was never a man who was interested in marriage or children, although he sired two children out of wedlock. And this was the great secret. He fled Sweden, telling the world that he was a political radical opposed to the military conscription, which was then mandatory in Sweden. And for this high noble purpose of being a social egalitarian and a man of the revolution, he came to the United States. But of course, as we found out later, it really was because he was afraid of being locked up for not taking care of these two children who were born of two separate mothers.
He's a walking dichotomy. He embraced the American way, but he stayed very close to his Swedish roots. He was in many ways selfish with his American family, but he was generous with his Swedish family. Like you mentioned, he fathered children, but he never wanted to be a dad. He wooed women, but never wanted to be a husband. What do you make of this guy who you really came to know as an old man?
I tried hard to love this man and understand him, and I guess the understanding part came in much later, largely through writing this book, but the love never was manifest. He lived in the United States for 65 years of his 89 years, and yet always considered himself a Swedish citizen above all. He had greater ties to Sweden than the U.S., although he prospered here and made a lot of money here. He never abandoned those political views, even though he became a successful capitalist, built many homes up and down the North Shore as a contractor, helped build Skokie to what it is today. And he was a complete puzzle to me. He was 56 years of age when I was born. My mother was his third of four wives. He was distant, aloof, cold, arrogant, imperious, and full of conviction about his politics, although he never practices politics. So really, in essence, he was a hypocrite. And it was really exposed to me the hypocrisies, the larger hypocrisies of the old political left. In a way, their beliefs legitimized bad behavior, social drinking, engaging in sexual relations with women outside of marriage. All of the kind of typical vices were given a kind of legitimacy by the old left and the stamp of approval that you were a social rebel by doing these things, and there's a glamorous cachet to that. But did they really embrace the movement? did they see and champion equality for minorities, for Jewish people, for women? No, absolutely not. The radicalism really extended only to the rights of the white working class man.
This is 848 on WBEZ. I'm Jason Mark, and I'm talking with Chicago historian and author Richard Lindberg. His latest book is Whiskey Breakfast, My Swedish Family, My American Life. Now, according to the book, nearly every member, not every, but nearly every member of your family is deeply flawed in some way. And you yourself faced physical and mental abuse from your father, from bullies for the majority of your childhood. Why relive these painful memories by writing this book?
I was in self-denial really up until the late 1980s and the death of my father. I tried to push behind those 8 years of horror at grammar school, being singled out as a weakling, as a kid who was different. I got through early adulthood just suppressing it. But then finally, when I got into my late 30s, I began thinking about it, and I became angrier about it. I became angry at my former classmates, angry at my father for denying me a chance to go to a decent college. I mean, I'm very grateful that I did go to college, but I always felt that I had to settle for less, both emotionally and as a kid who's just trying to survive economically. And the anger began to manifest. I did 4 years of therapy beginning in 2001 to help me come to terms with it. That, plus the catharsis of writing this book, has kind of given me a new light on it. And what I've been able to do is bury a lot of this in the past and try to forget.
Now, how did all this information about your father and your family come to you? And describe some of those feelings as these stories become revealed.
My grandmother always used to tell me that, you know, Richard, your father has bastards in Sweden. I heard that when I was 10 years old. I didn't quite understand the meaning of it, but that was in the background. I mean, it was always my father never talked about having sire children. It was a great shame, and he kept it a secret. It wasn't until his death in 1986 that I found a battered suitcase in the back of his closet in his home in Skokie, and I opened it up, and there were stacks of letters with ribbons wrapped around them. These letters were all written in Swedish, and they were in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. They were written to him by his friends and relatives in Sweden. I couldn't read a word of the language, so I prevailed upon my 30 cousins in Sweden to do that, and I kind of parsed them off to different people. I made 2 trips to Sweden to try to find out the answer to these old riddles. I searched through graveyards looking for the markers of these 2 half-brothers of mine who would have been in their 70s when I first went over there in 1987. They had died, but I could not find their markers. So the whole thing was a riddle and an enigma until all these letters finally get translated.
So if part of the Swedish psyche is to keep things inside or bury things that you don't want other people to know, why would your dad keep all of this correspondence?
Well, they were sacred reminders of a world he left behind. There were letters in there in the handwriting of his mother. And within several of these letters, I actually found fragments of leaves and flowers that his mother had put in there. And they had crumbled to dust when I opened them up. But I think that really it had to do mostly with his nostalgia for the place. He was a nostalgic expatriate. He was in love with the idea of Sweden, but not necessarily the outcome. Once all this social engineering had been completed in Sweden way back when, and he went back for the first time in the 50s and continued to go back later, he saw that the society had pretty much evolved. The social estate was in place. The spirit of radicalism of the 1920s had disappeared. Everybody was living at pretty much the same kind of lifestyle. He could not have gone back because he would have had to give up his Buick Electra 225. He would have to give up his big house in the suburbs. So he had left a Sweden that was vanished in history. And these letters were just the subtle reminders of a time and place.
Digging up all this correspondence and recognizing that he kept these for a number of reasons, including sentimental reasons, did any of that change your idea of who your dad was?
My father had a responsible side to him despite the alcoholism and the bad parenting. he believed in working to attain, and he did encourage the belief in me that through work comes reward, although I never saw it personally from him. He was a responsible man in many ways. He ran a very successful business for a number of years. He employed a number of tradesmen through some dark years. But really, the brutal character flaw of him was this overreaching ego. He never let you forget the fact that he started with nothing and he built this company and built all these wonderful houses. And in a sense, I think that gave me, perhaps motivated me to try to duplicate it. Certainly my brother, who was kind of the black sheep, emulated in amazing ways. He built 5 houses in California. He became a 32nd degree Mason. Because my father had done that, he too had to do that. Although he had no interest in the Masonic order and he was not a builder by trade, he did it to prove to the old man that he could. And I think that's kind of remarkable when you think about the impact of a father, even a dissolute alcoholic father.
Now, your dad never said, I love you, or never said, I'm proud of you. Have you managed to come to peace with that?
That's been hard. I was 25 years old when I published the first of my 16 books. And the night that I got the first copy off the press, he was the first person I showed it to. And I come walking into his living room. He looks at the cover and he says, well, how much did you get paid for this? And I had signed a bad contract. I had no advance on this little book. And it was just, but I was so proud of being an author. And he looks at it for 30 seconds, tosses it on the table next to him, and just completely ignored it from there. And I was devastated. I was crushed. Just once in my life, it would have been nice to say, son, I'm proud of you. But that never came from his lips. And that really was one of the hardest things. You know, you try, a boy always tries hard to please his father. You want to rise to certain expectations, but when criticism overrides accomplishment, it becomes a very, very sad and depressing thing. And that was really the biggest issue I had with him.
Richard Lindbergh is the biggest Sox fan ever born on the north side of Chicago. He's also an historian and the author of now 16 books. His newest is Whiskey Breakfast, My Swedish Family, My American Life. Rich, thanks so much for joining me today on 848.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'm Jason Mark, WBEZ.
Coming up after the break, food writer Louisa Chu. Now, she usually brings us sweet and tasty tales from the culinary scene, but this morning it's a little different. And so if you have a donut or something sweet, you might want to put that aside. She's got a recipe for rat. Yep, rat. And the question is, does it taste like chicken? Louisa Chu fills us in. That's just ahead right here on WBEZ's 848.